Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. You might think entrepreneurs would keep ideas underground until the economy gets better, but many say it's a great time to plant seeds for a new business.
They're taking an offensive rather than a defensive approach. They're actually trying to be more aggressive.
We'll hear from some startups on why they're going full speed ahead. Real estate's been on a roller coaster for the past few years, and for many, buying a home went from fun to scary.
From a way to build wealth and security to something that has stolen that security from so many people.
We track how the dream of ownership veered out of control. And remember when ATMs came out? You could get cash after banking hours. Well, now the bank comes to you.
Having financial access wherever you are, I think, is very much the next big thing.
Learn about the latest online financial tools, those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. States are facing massive budget deficits, and a big chunk of the budget axe is falling on higher education. To compensate, colleges and universities are hiking tuition and fees on students. And that means the bill for school may end up just out of reach. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
So what is a student to do with all the bad news coming out of state college systems? Here in California, tens of thousands of school employees face furloughs and pay cuts. In Pennsylvania, tuition is going up by almost 4%. Well, this week, President Barack Obama proposed that some $12 billion be spent over the next decade on community colleges around the country. It is much needed. Budget cuts are happening as enrollment soars. Tamara Keith has more.
Northern Virginia Community College is expecting a spike of students this fall. So is just about every other community college in the country. In tough economic times, these two-year schools become critical for people who've been laid off and need job retraining. Counselor Fran Troy says she's seeing more recent high school grads, too.
Because they got in where they wanted to at the four-year school, but economics is driving them back to us instead. They want to save money.
So her office is busy.
Matt, my name's Fran. What can I do for you?
Basically, I'm just coming in here so I can get just references on classes to take. Okay.
She tells the student to hurry up and register. Just about anyone can attend Virginia Community Colleges, but there's no guarantee they'll get a spot in every class they need.
I just know that we're seeing so much more volume, and it will be inevitable that there will be one or two classes that they can't get into.
Her advice? Be flexible. Be patient. Have a plan B. I caught student Megan Sullivan as she was walking across campus and asked her if she's ever had trouble getting into a class.
Oh, yeah. That's a regular thing. You better get used to it. I mean, that's how it is.
On the day registration opens, students stay up past midnight to be the first to sign up for required courses that fill up fast. Bob Templin, president of Northern Virginia Community College, knows why this is happening, and he doesn't like it.
Well, in the last 2 years, we've had our state funding cut by 10%, but I'm staring at an 11% increase in student enrollment in the fall, asking, how are we going to do this?
In California, the situation is even more dire. Fall enrollment is up 20% in the Los Rios Community College District, but Los Rios has to cut $30 million from its budget because of the state's cash shortfall. What does that mean for students? Just ask Kathleen Farron. She has to complete two specific classes to get into a dental hygiene program. But when she went to sign up,
every single anatomy and physiology class was full with a waiting list closed.
She did get on a waiting list for the other class, microbiology. But there's a chance Farron will be completely shut out this fall.
Those programs are terribly impacted, and it's not going to get better for a while, I fear.
Bryce Harris is the chancellor of the Los Rios Community Colleges.
You know, there's nothing I hate worse than knowing there are students who have personal and family responsibilities that depend on them getting the training they need to get a job, and they come to our institutions and they can't find the courses they need.
The state chancellor's office estimates that community colleges in California will turn away 250,000 students this year. I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
With so much of the country all down in the mouth about the economy, how about a bright spot? Some small business owners are using the recession to bolster their chances of survival. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went in search of some folks who are betting on the future despite the current odds. He reports from the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
The economy's slowed to a crawl. Banks and businesses don't want to take any risks these days. So it's refreshing to meet a man like Taryn Pitchka. He's obsessed with speed, and he's not daunted by the sharp twists and turns in the economy. Risk, in business anyway, doesn't seem to scare him one bit. Pitchka fires up a pedal-to-the-metal marketing video in his small Portland studio. He's showing me the latest designs from his startup clothing brand, Wicked Quick. He came up with the idea when he was working for Ford's racing team. He remembers standing between two dragsters as they went from 0 to 300 in 4 seconds flat.
And I seriously thought my teeth were going to fall out of my head. I thought at that moment, there's got to be a way to create a cool clothing brand around this fascination of speed.
The result fills his studio, piles of trim-cut designer t-shirts with eye-popping graphics in jet black, blood red, and aqua.
It's called Samurai Ride. It mixes unique print treatments such as foils, discharge prints.
Those designer tees go for up to $75 a piece, and Wicked Quick is about to introduce more designs for women. That kind of drive to expand doesn't surprise Deborah D'Agostino of the Economist Intelligence Unit. She's just put out a survey of small and mid-sized business owners.
What we found is that they're actually very optimistic about the future. They certainly feel that they will be in a good position when the economy recovers.
83% are optimistic about their company's prospects. Well over half think their market share and revenues will have increased by the end of the recession.
It appears from the survey results that they're taking an offensive rather than a defensive approach. They're actually trying to be more aggressive.
That's a good description of another entrepreneur I met in Portland, Marie Ritchie, founder of the Selwood Garden Club.
Well, this yard is a bit challenging in regards to the light situation.
Richie is checking out my backyard for its growth potential, which appears to be minimal.
We'd be kind of restricted to a few of the oddball shade crops like garlic chives.
No thanks. Still, Richie's found plenty of other backyards to plant veggies in. She sells them to local restaurants. In exchange for a weekly food basket, homeowners let her use their land and water for free. Richie says she and a partner launched on sheer faith before they'd signed up any homeowners.
I had no idea how many to expect. I put an ad up on Craigslist in January when we decided to make this our full-time venture and heard from about 7 or 8 people. And from those 7 or 8 people, it was all word of mouth.
Now there are 21 garden plots, plus they've started a guerrilla farmer's market.
What is this?
That is a rainbow lacinato kale?
It's just a scrappy Sunday gathering of small local vendors. Sales have been up every week. The Economist's Deborah D'Agostino says the most successful businesses are paying intense attention to what their customers want in this recession. So for Marie Ritchie, that's cheap, locally grown organic food. For the guys at Wicked Quick, it's something cool to wear. Chief Operating Officer Eric Happel says his fashion-forward consumers don't mind laying out $300 for jeans and a T-shirt. They care more about their image than their bank account.
Well, they certainly don't have the 401k, you know, sort of built up that took the biggest hit. So for that 18 to 28-year-old, you know, a lot of the investment that they're doing is still in themselves and, you know, in today.
Wicked Quick sales have doubled every year since they launched in 2005. They're on track to double again this year in spite of the recession. Founder Taryn Pitchka says he's run this race carefully.
You can't imagine trying to raise money in the middle of this. So we decided to really play it safe, play it close, really bootstrap it, keep everything small, focus on design, watch every nickel and penny. Now we have survived, and retail looks like it's starting to come around. It's looking a lot more positive. We think the future looks really bright.
Looking at recent retail trends, Pichka might seem like he's out to lunch. But Deborah D'Agostino says it's in the nature of entrepreneurs to be optimistic, whatever the economic data might be saying.
It's entirely possible that this optimism is a bit overblown and that companies are, in the long run, not going to be as successful as they hope to be. I think many business leaders, when they're asked to talk about the future of their business, tend to be bullish, no matter what is happening in the economy.
D'Agostino says most of the business owners in her survey expect a quick and strong rebound once the recession's over. She's not so optimistic, but then she's not an entrepreneur. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Jack Welch stepped into the so-called mommy wars recently. At a human resources conference, the former head of General Electric said there is no such thing as work-life balance. There are work-life choices. Now, many women can have a family and a career, he said, but by taking time off to raise children, their chances of rising to the top of their chosen profession get smaller. In this week's Straight Story, economics editor Chris Farrell offers his take on the debate.
To be fair, we all have to make trade-offs. Economists are fond of saying, there is no free lunch. Or as Mick Jagger, lead singer of the Rolling Stones and a former student at the London School of Economics, put it,
you can't always get what you want.
Jagger's right. You simply can't get around trade-offs. And anyone with the ambition and the drive to try to become a great artist, a famous writer, and yes, a CEO, makes sacrifices. Thanks for the reminder, Jack. But then why inject gender into the equation? He implied that women could not succeed in business, let alone make it into the executive suite, without sacrificing family. And that's where I think he's spouting nonsense. For one thing, the list of women who are rising to the top of their chosen field and manage to have families is long and growing. Take the experience of Ursula Burns. At Xerox, she recently became the first African-American woman to lead a major U.S. corporation, and she succeeded a woman. Both women are also mothers. Senior management at Xerox was early and strong in its commitment to diversity over the past several decades. For instance, senior leadership evaluated managers on their ability to recruit and mentor underrepresented groups, and their earnings and promotion prospects took a hit if they fell short. Today, one-third of the company's executives are women. But corporate initiative, no matter how impressive, isn't enough. What about changing the rules for climbing the corporate ladder on an economy-wide scale? Imagine how it would affect the trade-offs young adults face, both men and women, if we had equal pay for equal work, high-quality daycare, and good after-school programs. The impact of family-friendly policies like these would be dramatic. We'd end up with even more competition from women for the leadership ranks of society. We'd also have better family values. Sounds good to me.
What's your take on the work-life balance? Write to us at marketplace.org. If you've got kids, no school means more quality time with them. Maybe too much.
It's summer. And since we can't afford all those camps and clinics, our kids are home all day long.
Family project, home brew. It could keep them busy and you sane. That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We Americans have carried around a lot of assumptions about real estate. That buying a home is always a good investment. That home prices only go up. Well, here's the reality check. Foreclosures soared by almost 15% in the first half of this year. So where did all those assumptions begin? Alyssa Katz has a few answers in her new book, Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. I asked her what went wrong with the American dream of everyone owning a home.
I think what went wrong is that home ownership ended up becoming a political tool. You know, in the middle of the Great Depression, the Roosevelt administration created the Federal Housing Administration, which insured home mortgages and extended those mortgages to 30 years so that a borrower could pay off this debt slowly over time, which really opened up home ownership to millions of people who otherwise could never have achieved it.
So when did we start thinking of it in different terms?
Going forward into the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, because those federal programs hadn't been available by and large to Black home buyers, to Latino home buyers, because of various discriminatory policies, this kind of became a political opportunity to say, you know, let's finish this unfulfilled dream and bring home ownership to all.
And then that really paired with people all of a sudden looking around, seeing all their neighbors and friends buy homes. And it was almost like you were entitled to own your own home.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, this happened through a combination of, you know, very, very well-intentioned programs and policies. The problem would come in when, you know, people would be able to either refinance with a subprime or other less well-constructed mortgage, or when they would, you know, in recent years, find opportunities to simply buy homes with no money down, stated income, and so on. I mean, many, many lenders had programs that would deliberately target first-time home buyers. I mean, Countrywide in particular was a pioneer in this, seeking what they would call new markets, borrowers who previously wouldn't have been able to get a home mortgage.
Have you seen any change in the winds in terms of this notion that we all should be owning homes?
There are really two stories going on here. In Washington, it's all about preserving, you know, near universal home ownership as a goal. With the markets in crisis and current owners unable to sell, just making sure there's a supply of buyers there to keep the market afloat is really essential. So we have things like the first-time home buyers tax credit. I think among the American public, there's a lot more ambivalence because there's been just an enormous shift in a sense of what home ownership represents, having gone from a way to build wealth and security to something that has stolen that security from so many people.
Do you own your own home?
I do, reluctantly.
Reluctantly? Why reluctantly?
Well, I grew up in New York City, and New York City is a city of renters. My apartment lost its protections under rent regulation. I had been a renter, and suddenly I found that my building was turning into a condominium. And the developer of this condo was offering apartments that we had rented for $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. And that simply was a commitment that we, you know, I individually and my family weren't prepared to make. So we did end up buying, but buying elsewhere. But it was really out of a quest for security, wanting to raise a family, knowing that we wouldn't get kicked out at the end of the year. And that was ultimately what made us make the decision to buy.
You think you'd ever want to go back to renting?
I don't know. I'm starting to like home ownership.
There you go. I think that is probably the primary argument for home ownership, is that it's really nice. You get to do your own stuff with your own place.
It is. I mean, if we borrowed much less than the cost of our apartment and really made sure that it fit within our budget. And I think that's so critical here.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the 1930s, you know, the typical home that those new borrowers were buying cost maybe two or three times that family's annual income. Now it's very difficult to find a place that's within a family's budget.
Alyssa Katz is the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
So when does your house own you? Well, it might be when you want to move, but you can't because the old place won't sell. And more owners are swapping for sale signs to for rent. In fact, one of them is Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. His New York home didn't sell after several months, so if you are looking for a swank Tudor-style crash pad in Larchmont, New York, it's yours for $7,500 a month. We met with another family that's become accidental landlords. Scott and Jerry Okamoto found a great deal on a bigger house in their Pasadena, California neighborhood called Bungalow Heaven. I met them while they were packing and cleaning up for their new tenants.
Welcome to our half-empty house. This is the living room. This is about 1,100 square foot bungalow. It's a 1904 Craftsman.
And what made you decide to move?
Just the space. We love the neighborhood. We love our neighbors. So when we found a house exactly a block to the west, we thought, That's perfect because we can sort of keep our neighbors, stay in the neighborhood, uh-huh. but also have a house twice the size.
Well, should we head to the backyard here?
Sure, if you can make your way through
the leaves.
This is the deck that Jerry designed.
And built.
Of course. So you're leaving for a bigger place. Did you try to sell this?
We didn't even try, really. We've seen our neighbors take about 6 months to a year to sell.
We thought that we could find someone to be able to lease our house out to cover the current mortgage, and then we can wait for the market to return in order to sell our house at a higher value.
You're about to become landlords. Is that something you ever particularly wanted to do?
No,
it wasn't in like the master plan of how, you know, we thought that this would be our starter home. And we would live here about 5 years and then upgrade to a nicer home. And also at that time, the housing prices just got so out of reach that if we sold this house at the highest part of the market, we wouldn't be able to buy something any larger.
Well, what about some of the real practical stuff? You have to be ready to hire a plumber or be the plumber yourself. You know, things like that are still your responsibility.
Yeah, fortunately. I'm speaking, but I'm about to say my wife is the contractor of the family. She does. She was like 6 months pregnant, sweating a pipe underneath the house. Most things we can fix ourselves.
Yeah, but what if, say, you're on vacation?
That's a good question.
Uh-oh.
I haven't thought of that one.
It's a good thing our tenants can't hear this conversation.
Well, actually, they could. Dave and Shandy Carlson are moving into the Okamoto's house this August, and they joined in the conversation in their backyard. They're becoming accidental landlords as well.
We tried to put our house up on the market about 2 years ago. After about 8 months, we decided to pull out and take the house off the market because we knew we weren't going to get what we wanted for it. 2 years later, Scott and Jerry said that their house was, they were going to be looking for people to rent it. And so we'd always loved the idea of moving to Pasadena because it's closer to our friends and our church.
So have you sold your house?
No.
No, we haven't.
No. So you're renting out too?
Yeah.
So you are becoming renters, and then you are also going to be accidental landlords.
Yes.
Exactly.
Was that part of the plan, Shandy?
No. No, we hope to sell our place and get into a new home, get a little bit more space, get a backyard. But this is working out well because we're getting a backyard, we're getting a new space.
Do you feel like you're ready to be landlords?
Not yes everything.
And, yes and no. Being reluctant landlords, we're both learning how to be landlords together.
Yeah. Learning it for the first time, trying to figure out the legalities of it, that there are legalities of it, that there are forms that we should all probably start filling out. Don't even know what those forms are.
I did. I picked up the first form today at the Pasadena permit office because there's an occupancy requirement that the city of Pasadena requires you to have the property inspected.
If you're going to rent it out?
If you're going to rent it out.
Huh, just like if you were going to sell it.
Exactly.
So we're hoping to get it all fixed up and cleaned so they can move in August.
And Dave, so then you have someone set to move into your condo in August?
Yeah, towards the end of August. They're students, so they'll move in and we'll move out. And as far as, you know, we're anticipating, it should be pretty smooth.
All right, well, let us know how it's going. Maybe we'll visit next year and make sure you're all still friends.
Yes, hopefully we'll still be smiling in a year's time.
Well, thanks for inviting us into your backyard, and good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott, Jerry, Dave, and Shandy do have a lot to learn, including the legal issues involved in this kind of deal. For the top five things you should take care of if you're going to become an accidental landlord, check out our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. By Gather.com, where friends keep up with people, conversations, and moments that matter. People are talking about their family's economy at Gather.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding, online at finrafoundation.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we hear your financial questions and hopefully give some sound advice. Chris Farrell is back with us to answer some calls. And Chris, we've got Emily on the phone from Orlando, Florida. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, how are you?
Oh, good. A little warm down here.
How warm is it?
Uh,
I would say warm enough to have the air conditioner down.
Ah, there you go. Well, what's your question for us today?
Well, I'm a 48-year-old freelancer, and I have to do all of my own investing. One of my investment tools has been an IRA.
Excellent.
My accountant has advised me that it's probably best to have this so I could get the tax write-off.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep hearing from everybody that a Roth is better. His feeling is a Roth will not give me the tax write-off now. But I know in 2010 the rules are changing a bit, and I was wondering if it's something I should consider doing in 2010.
Yeah, Chris, this is something that I think we're going to be getting more and more questions on. You know, is it the time now to roll over the traditional IRA into a Roth IRA?
Well, this is the conversion gold rush. It used to be there was a $100,000 limit after you made some adjustments before you could convert a traditional IRA into a Roth. It's going to be gone in 2010. But there's something else that happens in 2010. It's a one-time offer. You get to choose whether you pay the tax in 2010 or spread it out over the 2 years. And that's why there's so much excitement about this conversion.
But Chris, it really sounds like the key there is to make sure that you have the money to pay the taxes on this rollover.
You're absolutely right, Tess. There's a couple questions that you have to ask yourself. Will this make sense for me? If you have other savings and you can use those savings to pay the taxes, conversion often makes sense. But if you're using money from that you're withdrawing from the conversion itself, it usually doesn't make sense. There are some decent calculators, the Roth IRA conversion calculators. Dinkytown.net is one of them. I like their calculators. They're very good. This is something that you want to research before you leap because there's going to be a lot of hype out there.
Great. Thank you so very, very much.
Thanks for the call, Emily. Good luck.
Thank you.
Let's see what Joe has to say. He's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Tess.
How can we help you out today?
Well, I've got some questions about a Roth IRA.
A Roth IRA. Well, we just answered a few other questions about a Roth IRA, so tell us what yours is.
It's Tess's favorite subject, by the way.
Well, I'm glad I'm not alone. About 6 or 7 years ago, I opened a Roth IRA. I started putting not a lot of money, $100 a month into it. Fast forward to about March, and I realize that it's losing value faster than I'm putting money into it.
Uh-oh.
So I stop contributing to it. And then a couple of months later, I got to thinking, you know, it's a few thousand dollars there. I've got another IRA. I'm going to close the account. After surrender fees and the capital losses on the account, I ended up with, maybe about $2,000 less than I had put into it over the years.
Oh, my.
So I'm wondering, can I claim a loss because this is after-tax dollars, and do I have to pay the 10% penalty for closing the account before I retire?
Yeah, I don't think the penalty applies because you actually withdrew less than what you had put in, right, Chris?
That's correct. So the answer is probably.
Probably he can take a loss. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Now, you really should consult with a professional, look at your particular tax situation to make sure. But here are the rules to claim a loss on your taxes. You must liquidate all your Roth IRAs. So you got none left.
Check, yeah.
The amount of money you have at liquidation has to be less than your basis. You have to itemize on your taxes to claim the loss. Then the amount that can be deducted is limited to 2% of adjusted gross income.
Okay, so it sounds like I need to talk it out with my tax preparer come April.
Absolutely.
All right, well, good luck, Joe. Thanks for the call.
All right, thanks.
Well, if you've got questions, do give us a call. You can leave a message anytime at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
We cross booze off the shopping list when we turn frugal. And at first, feeling high from our initial penny-pinching successes, I wasn't complaining.
Hodding Carter has been blogging about his new frugal existence for gourmet.com. Think family of six, $550 a month to live on. That's after the mortgage payment. Here is his latest installment for us.
Now, however, it's summer. And since we can't afford all those camps and clinics, our kids are home all day long. Everywhere I turn, there's a kid. On my computer, on my cell phone, even on my toilet. And although we're having a blast and each of them has said this is their favorite summer ever, And why not, since they spend most of their days just being kids, jumping on the trampoline, fighting, building forts, fighting, swimming in the lake, fighting, I often find myself longing for a glass of liquid daddy helper. And that's why I'm attempting to make mead, the mother of all booze. Mead is so old that no one really knows when or where it began, only that its arrival probably accompanied the dawn of civilization. It was the first fermented beverage. Being such, one might assume any simpleton can make it. Combine honey with water at a ratio of 1 pound honey to 1 gallon water, add yeast, and voila! A month or more down the road, depending on how strong you want it, you've got golden alcohol. Unless you try making it with an old, forgotten jug of blackstrap molasses and baker's yeast, swirled together in random proportions, bottled in a musty 5 gallon plastic water container bought days after 9/11. In that situation, you end up with burnt sugar-tasting vinegar. Hearing of my failure, an acquaintance gave me a 5 gallon glass carboy, a container specifically designed for making fermented beverages, and also a bottle of his very own batch number 11. He couldn't remember what he did to make it. People add all sorts of things, like herbs, fruit, and secret ingredients to spice up their mead, but one sip erased all the aches and pains of being frugal. It was a heaven-sent elixir with a kick and sweetness of port, followed up with a light but complex taste of, you guessed it, honey. On my next trip to the liquidation grocery store, I found 5 pounds of Chinese honey at $1.76 a pound and was quickly brewing my very own batch number 2 atop my office desk. It's a copacetic existence, our kids' summer recess and the salutary mead making. Every time I find myself about to explode, I dash into the study to count out loud and wait for a bubble of CO2 to pass through the carboy's water lock. It used to take 5 seconds between bubbles of escaping mead gases and an equal amount of time for me to calm down. As the mead's alcohol level has increased and the sugar's gotten eaten up, the bubbles have grown further and further apart. Coincidentally, as the kids have stayed indoors because of endless rain, it's also taken me longer and longer to quell my own uncool parent response. Around the same time next month, though, I'll be done with counting. The kids will be back in school, and the mead will be ready to drink. Who says being frugal doesn't have its rewards?
W. Hodding Carter is writing about his family's experience with extreme frugality at gourmet.com. You can see photos of him and his mead at marketplace.org. Last week, we brought you a story about Advanta Bank. It's one of the largest suppliers of small business credit cards in the country. Well, the FDIC had been paying close attention to Advanta after customers complained about canceled credit lines, high interest rates, and the like. But Advanta was continuing to sell short-term securities. Now, as a result of our story, Advanta has stopped issuing those notes. The SEC is looking into the company. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I don't generally consider myself a Luddite, but when it comes to tracking and managing our household finances, apparently I am, because I use an old-fashioned method, Quicken, on my home computer. Boy, am I behind the times. I am inexplicably, inexcusably, missing out on the beauty of online money management. So, here to give all of us dinosaurs an education is CNET's editor-at-large, Brian Cooley. And let's start with the online websites. Let's use one of the more popular ones, maybe, mint.com. This is for...
It's for tracking, budgeting, and managing money. You can categorize and graph finances. It'll do this automatically as well. You can track investments. It ties into a lot of different bank services and billing services. And that's another thing you want to check is how many billers and payers does the given online service you're considering tie into. It can range from 1,000 or more for some of these sites down to a few hundred for others. And so they may miss the ones that you need tied in.
Mm-hmm. Are there... specific sites that you can recommend that are more functional than others?
Well, Mint tends to be one that has some of the most hooks in it. Yodlee, there are plenty of up-and-comers because it's easy to launch a web service compared to launching software that you have to get people to buy and install. If you go over to webware.com, which is our site that follows these kinds of online services, we have this constant ebb and flow as we watch these guys add services and have a nuclear arms race against each other of who has the latest in terms of functionality, who has the latest in terms of more and more bank and merchant partners. So you got to bear that in mind as well. If the feature's not there, take 3 deep breaths and it might be there.
Okay, we'll have a link to WebWare on our website as well. What about the services that banks themselves provide in terms of allowing you to keep track of all your finances in one place? Are those any better or any worse than a site like Yodlee?
Those have become very mature in the last, I want to say the last 3 years. I've really seen those jump ahead because that's about the same time we started to see research into the number of people who are using online banking really starting to arc. And the banks began to notice this a few years ago and really started to spend, I think, more time and money on their sites, making them feel like modern websites. Because prior to that, if you haven't done online banking in, let's say, 5 years, you may recall a very kludgy experience.
When we talk about the difference between, you know, the stuff that stays on your computer versus doing this kind of putting everything in one website, you know, my first reaction is concern about having all of that information in one place. Now, you look into this kind of technology all the time. So can you tell me that these online banking sites are at least 99% safe?
No.
No, okay.
It's the web. Whenever you put something out on a machine that you don't own and you don't have the controls to, a server, a service like any of these banking websites, you're taking a layer of the onion and peeling it away. You're taking away some of the insulation around your information. But with that said, the online banking websites, the banking services are they're younger. They're newer. We haven't seen the mother of all breaches of them yet. And let's face it, that's where the industries tend to learn how to do things better. So, you know, I'd have a little trepidation about it myself.
Well, there's another kind of avenue that people can take with this, which is the smartphone applications. Now, there are all kinds of ways where you can manage your money through your, you know, your iPhone or your Palm Pre, whatever you've chosen to use. What do you think of these?
I think that they go to the very core of online banking, which is location and moment. So if you need to do a financial transaction, whether it's the idea of moving money around for a big purchase that you just realized you're going to make, or whether it's covering a bill that you realize, whoops, was due yesterday, having financial access wherever you are, I think is very much the next big thing. The idea here is to distill into the smartphone just the essential functions. Check your balance, transfer money, make a payment. That's all you need on a smartphone application in many cases. You don't need to go and have a home budget tracker. You'll do that on your computer.
Right.
You don't need to have a stock portfolio builder and tracker, maybe a simple version of it. There are applications like there's a Bloomberg app for the iPhone that is really good. It's a great portal into looking at trades and the market trends. There are loan calculators for the iPhone that are really great, and they're simple. So I hope it stays that way and that the developers out there don't start making these things increasingly complex just to show what they can do.
All right. Brian Cooley is CNET's editor at large. Thanks for sniffing all this out with us.
Yes, you're welcome.
What online personal finance tool can't you live without? Write to us at marketplace.org, where you will also find Brian Cooley's top 10 list.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
We are back with more Getting Personal, and I'm joined once again by our own Chris Farrell. And Chris, we've got Amanda on the phone from Indianapolis. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
I was calling because my husband and I are expecting our first child Thanksgiving, and we were...
Congratulations.
Thanks. And we've been advised by parenting books and that kind of thing to be looking into wills, primarily for guardianship issues.
Yes. Oh, you've got Chris very excited.
Absolutely. Very pleased.
So my husband and I, we don't have very many assets. It's not in terms of anything being complicated, it's much more that we just want to have something established so that if something were to happen, that the kid would be taken care of and that shouldn't be an issue.
Yep.
So what I was looking for was answers about whether or not coming up with the dog.
And who's going to take care of the dog?
Yeah, exactly.
So my husband and I were wondering was whether or not it would pay off to consult a lawyer, or if we should try to look through online services or software programs that you can buy to create your own will from home. We don't know whether or not it'd be better to, you know, pay a little bit more up front to consult a lawyer and not have some weirdness occur in the will, because we tried to do it on our own and it missed something.
Yeah, you definitely don't want that weirdness.
Uh-huh.
So, Chris, no. What do you think of these online products versus going to a lawyer?
You know, I've used the online product and I thought it was very good, but I would strongly urge you to work with a lawyer.
Okay.
Here's my reason. These are difficult topics. You're talking about what if you die, whether your husband dies. And then you're getting into areas about guardianship. And then there's some things that we just don't really think about. And the advantage of going to a professional is that they know all the questions to ask. You know, this is a big life change. And this is one of those times where I just think there's a benefit to asking questions and being asked questions.
That sounds like it makes sense. If you do a consult a lawyer, are wills always individual? So husband has one, wife has one, or can you do a joint one?
You do a joint one.
Okay.
Both have to sign it and all of that and agree to it and everything. Now, I also, since I have you, have you talked about life insurance?
Haven't reviewed what my employer has offered, and we haven't looked for anything beyond that yet.
Okay. So when you're having a child, you've taken the one important step, which is a will. The other important step is life insurance, term life insurance. Make it simple, make it easy. Check out your employer plan. That's wonderful. I think that's great that you're doing that. But again, life insurance is important because if something does happen, you want to protect the child financially.
All right.
Does that help you out?
Yes, it does. Very much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling in. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And next we have Rachel on the phone in San Diego, California. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
So what's your question for us today?
Well, I'm just getting ready to go to grad school. I've applied for my student loans, and I just went through the whole process, and it scared me a bit, just looking at the amount I'll be taking out, of course, and then the amount in interest. And I'm just wondering, you know, is there other ways to go? I applied for the federal subsidized and unsubsidized loans, and the interest is 6.8 interest. And I'm wondering, is there a private lender a better way to go?
Uh-oh. No. Ooh, no. Okay. Run. No private lender.
No,
you will never get a better interest rate than from the government, at least on student loans.
And it's not even just the interest rate. The advantage of the federal government loans is you have a lot of flexibility. What are you going to get a degree in?
Oriental medicine and acupuncture.
Okay. So when you graduate, I don't know what your income will be and whether you'll start out at a lower income or a higher income. But the advantage of the federal loans is that you have a great deal of flexibility when it comes to paying it back. And there's like four major options. You know, one is just the straightforward standard. You pay it off over 10 years. But there's also a thing called a graduated repayment program, which you can choose. And that is you start out low and then it just keeps rising every 2 years up to a certain level. You can do an extended payment plan, which extends it out to 25 years. Now, the price of all these things is that it increases the total cost of your loan. But here's the key. There's no prepayment penalty. So if you're not earning much money in the early years, you sort of can buy yourself some relief. And then as you start earning a better income, you can be more aggressive and pay off the loans over a shorter period of time. If you go to a private lender, they're going to say, pay us back on the schedule we gave you.
All right, and that's it.
So what do you think, Rachel? You going to stick with the plan that the school offered?
That sounds like it's the only way to go, really.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Okay. Have a great day.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions, but you can give us a call anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or go to marketplace.org, and there you will find not only the Getting Personal link to write us, but also Chris's blog, where he's got all kinds of answers to more of your questions. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Des.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Last September's collapse of Lehman Brothers is widely considered the event that pulled the pin on an economic grenade. But in fact, the financial system began to combust more than a year earlier. In mid-July of 2007, Bear Stearns announced that two of its hedge funds, once valued at $16 billion, were suddenly worth nothing.
They had put huge bets in investments in subprime mortgages, and the housing market was on the verge of collapse. Today, 2 years hence, we can only wish it was all just a bad dream. Instead, the reality of this enormous mess has left a trail of destruction from coast to coast and just about everywhere in between. Chrissy Clark has one of those stories from In Between, a Sin City mortgage broker who was done in by a mania that he helped feed.
Stephen Doolin was far from Wall Street when those Bear Stearns hedge funds collapsed that fateful day in July. But 2,500 miles away, in Las Vegas, he still had an intimate link to the source of all the trouble. That's because Steve was a mortgage broker. This was back when almost anyone could get a mortgage. And as Steve will tell you, almost anyone could sell one, even him.
I knew nothing about the loan business. I was in construction my whole life. And I walked into my friend's office, he was a broker, in my construction clothes, and I said, give me a job. He was making about $40,000 a month. I said, well, you know, why can't I make this kind of money? He said, you can.
Steve made $100,000 his first year, selling all sorts of loans. Subprime loans with higher interest rates for people with bad credit. Adjustable rate loans, where the interest rate jumped up after the first few years. So-called liar loans that you could get without proving you had a job or any money in the bank. Steve got really good making even the shakiest deals go through. He made friends with the loan underwriters. They're the ones who go over loan applications and have final say on who to lend to.
I was taking underwriters from banks to lunch or sending them gift cards and everything because I knew that if I had a problem loan, we could work it out.
It was the height of the real estate feeding frenzy, and Steve was one of the guys feeding it. He insists he never sold a loan to someone he didn't think could afford one. And Steve didn't just sign other people up for loans. He got one for himself, too, for a big house in a gated community and a lot of new stuff for his family. At the time, he could afford all the payments.
I made a crap load of money really fast. Well, more money than I, not a crap load of money, but more money than I was used to making. And if you want to, you know, do better for your family, say you buy a bigger house or you buy a new car or you do that, you know, so I bought a new house, I bought a couple cars. And like a fool, I upgraded like people do. I spent.
Maybe you've already guessed what happened next, but it's useful to remember some of the excruciating details. The stories of fallen fortunes have become so common these days, they take on a kind of forgettable shorthand. Here's what happened to Steve. He became a victim of his own success. The mortgages he and his colleagues had gotten rich off of started collapsing, and so many homeowners were defaulting on their loans, banks kept tightening standards about who to lend to. Steve and his colleagues lost a lot of clients. Mortgage businesses started failing by the dozens, then the hundreds. Steve's firm was one of them. He went from making six figures a year to making nothing, and he wasn't prepared for it.
I kept thinking it was going to get better, it's going to get better, and it just got worse and worse and worse.
Without a job, Steve found himself in the same boat as many of the people he'd sold loans to. By the fall of 2008, this former mortgage broker couldn't pay the mortgage on the house he lives in with his wife and four kids. When I visited Steve again this spring, he'd put back on his construction clothes and was doing odd jobs out of his garage.
These are backdrops for an art gallery. I'm not even a finished carpenter. But you gotta take what you can get. I have tried to find a job everywhere. In this town, I have applied at gas stations, at supermarkets, at hotels, at restaurants, every construction company you can possibly think of, and I can't find a job, and that's scary. I just try to breathe right now.
His family had cut back in every way they could think of.
We are looking at welfare right now to see if we qualify for food stamps to make it easier, borrowing money from our neighbors and not being able to pay it back.
My wife went to the store, and if she was here, I wouldn't even talk to you about it, because she gets really down about it when we start talking about it.
He looks off into the distance for a sec.
I hope people learn how to use their money properly, how to save their freaking money, because when you have none and you're forced to swallow your pride and then ask for, you know, if you to borrow, or you're selling stuff that you would never sell, or, I mean, I play guitar. Playing guitar is like my life, and I have pawned. I sold all of my equipment, all of my guitars except for one. I have one left, and I won't get rid of it, I hope.
Before I left that day, I asked Steve to play me some of his music. He thought about it, agreed to, and then said no. He was out of practice, and one of his guitar strings was broken anyway. But a few days later, He sent me this recording he made of his music. That's what we've been listening to. A couple weeks ago, Steve finally found a job after being unemployed for more than 2 years. He'll be doing maintenance on cell phone towers. Steve's just glad he's back to work and earning a paycheck. The boom days are gone, but he's okay with that.
I hope that it never comes back the way that it was, because then we might end up in the same mess again.
Steve wants his family and the rest of the country to recover from the recession, but not forget it. In Las Vegas, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace Money.
And for more coverage of how the recession is affecting people's lives, go to marketplace.org and click on The Big Shift. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, want to buy a Mac laptop for $36? Yeah, there is a catch. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivin Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivin.com.
American Public Media.